Chapter 7. Gary hung up, went straight to his bedroom and took a small suitcase from the top of his wardrobe. He filled it with enough off-duty clothes to tide him over for a couple of nights, plus a few personal bits, and checked that all his windows were shut. He was ready to go in 20 minutes. He could sort out what to take for a longer stay after he'd talked to Marie. He had gathered from her call that she was more angry than frightened. The two of them together would have had a better chance of catching Ashcroft's messenger boy. No matter what her reason, Gary was glad she had turned to him. He had hated thinking of her alone in her house with that murdering psycho in the neighbourhood. He locked up and put his things in his car. Marie only lived 5 minutes away on the other side of Sutterthorpe Village, so rather than drive straight to her house, he decided to cruise around the village, keeping a lookout for fugitive youths. The bus shelter and the churchyard, both favourite haunts, were empty. Seeing no one suspicious, he headed for Marie's place. When he arrived, he found a lone socko, a new lad called Thomas Keane, carefully dusting her front door for prints. The motorcycle was still on the drive, the garland of artificial flowers decorating the handlebars. Marie came out to meet him.
"I appreciate this, Gary."
"Rubbish. You only asked me because you got fed up of your own cooking." He grinned at her, then added, "You're okay, though, really."
"I'm just so mad at that son of a bitch. The thought of him watching Jackman and me snapping pictures of us, it's an intrusion."
"Journalists do it for a living."
"They aren't planning on killing anyone," she retorted. "Come on in. Thomas has got a bit to do yet." I suddenly realised that the letterbox is quite stiff and my postie always has to lift the flap to get my mail through. Thomas said there's a nice big thumbprint on the underside, so hopefully our delivery boy will be known to us.
They went through to the kitchen and Marie made tea. I gave the village a quick recce on the way over, but there were no suspicious-looking little beggars around. I'm betting he's long gone. He was like a whippet, went over that bloody great fence like a rat up a drainpipe. I stood no chance.
"But you got his jacket, that's brilliant," Gary said.
"Thomas has it all bagged up. He'll take it back to the lab with his samples. If we've ever collared that lad before, we should get a match."
Gary nodded. "If we get him in an interview room and put the frighteners on him, he might be a lead to Ashcroft."
Marie looked doubtful. "I'm not so sure about that. Ashcroft's clever. He'll get some street kid to do his dirty work, pay him, and move on to the next hard-up teenager. I doubt they see him more than twice, and don't forget, Ashcroft loves his disguises."
"I suppose so, but that jacket could be important."
Marie handed him a mug of tea. "I think I must have always known this day would come because I've kept your room made up and ready. You can take your stuff up there any time you like. Have you eaten yet?" He shook his head.
"I hadn't got that far."
"Fish and chips, when Thomas is finished?" she asked.
"Smashing. I'll go and pick some up."
The village didn't have much by way of amenities, but like so many Lincolnshire villages and small towns, it had a cracking chippy.
"I've got a better idea. We'll go and eat there," Marie said. "My treat."
It wasn't a big shop, but it did have a small cafe out the back, where a fish supper with mushy peas, scraps and bread and butter, plus a giant mug of tea, cost little more than a takeaway.
"I need to do something normal, something ordinary, like eating a big plate of haddock and chips with a good friend. Something that has nothing to do with crime, subterfuge or death," Marie declared.
"Sounds perfect," Gary said.
"Talking to the Keyes family earlier, fair rung me out. I could do with a large helping of the commonplace too."
"We have to order place in advance," Marie said.
"Very droll."
He sipped his tea, suddenly pensive.
"How do we cope, Marie? I wonder sometimes. It could be a shitty job."
"If you could go back to the start, knowing what you know now, would you do it all again?" Marie asked. He didn't answer immediately. After a while, he said, "I would, because I'd never believed that the bad bits could be so awful. But I definitely wouldn't go to Harland Marsh. That place, and some other people who worked there, drains your very soul. You and Jackman were the saving of me. I was just about to throw it all in when you turned up and got me transferred to Salton. You're a good copper, Gary. Jackman appreciates that. Our team wouldn't be the same without you. He flushed with pride. How about you? Without a doubt. It's in my blood, Marie said. I've always known this was what I was cut out for, and I've never had the slightest doubt that I'm in the right job. They sat drinking tea, each lost in their own thoughts. Then Gary said, Did that lad look familiar? Like one of our regular troublemakers? I only saw the back of him, but no, I can't say I recognised him at all. Marie paused, thinking. He was just a scruffy kid with slightly straggly dark hair, faded jeans, battered trainers and a sweaty stained camouflage T-shirt.
Pretty good description. Shall I circulate it?
He asked. Already done. After I rang you, I called it into uniform. Not that I'm expecting them to find him. He'll have gone to ground. And I nearly had him, the little tow rag.
Have you phoned Jackman, Marie?
She bit her lip. No, not yet.
Marie, why? He'll skin you alive if he finds out about this from someone else.
It wasn't like the Sarge. She and Jackman operated in tandem, always. What was up? He leaned forward.
Okay, lady, spill the beans.
Marie put down her mug with a groan.
I will ring him, but... Oh, he seems so over-anxious about our safety. I wanted to spare him more worry. Let him have a night's sleep without imagining all sorts of horrifying scenarios.
I think he has every right to be anxious, don't you? He's the one with the responsibility.
We are his team, and if anything happens to any of us, the blame will fall on his shoulders.
It's not just that, Gary. But all day he's been acting oddly, even before Ashcroft raised his head. I've caught him looking at me as if he'd been told I had a terminal illness. Frankly, it unnerved me.
I wouldn't know about that, but you really should talk to him, Marie. Play it down by all means and tell him I'm here with you, but fill him in, for heaven's sake.
He looked towards the house phone.
Go on, do it now, and then we can have our supper in peace.
Okay, but only if you do me a favour and watch him tomorrow, will you? I'd value your opinion in case I've turned neurotic all of a sudden.
It's a deal.
Gary couldn't help hearing Marie inform Jackman of what had happened. She kept it as light as possible, assuring him that Gary was with her and apologising for not contacting him sooner. She listened a while and put the receiver down.
That was tricky, Gary.
But it's done now. I never knew you were such a good liar, Sarge.
I should be. I've mixed with some class acts over the past 2 decades, haven't I? She said dryly.
Sergeant Evans, I'm just about through here. Thomas called from the hallway. You might want to put that awesome bike somewhere safe for the night.
Dead right.
She's going under lock and key, don't you worry. She went to the door.
Did you get anything useful, Thomas?
Oh, there's a fair bit of stuff there, but that thumbprint is a corker. I'll get the lab to ring you tomorrow. He gathered up his aluminium cases and carried them to his car. We'll pay a special attention to that hoodie, Sarge. There may be a hair with a follicle on it that could give us DNA.
Thanks, Thomas. Much appreciated.
Marie watched him go, and then turned back to Gary.
Right, I'll put the bike away. Then we can act like ordinary people for a bit.
Perfect.
Kevin Stoner, now in civvies, walked slowly along Water Lane, a wide pathway running alongside a straight deep drain. To a stranger, this might have looked like a well-kept river, but the fens were crisscrossed with waterways like this one, most man-made. Water Lane led from the outskirts of Salton Town to a large expanse of waste ground. There had been great excitement when it was rumoured that a major player was buying this piece of land to build a supermarket, but the project had fallen through, and it had been left to become overgrown and desolate. The walls between the open space and the railway track were now daubed with graffiti, and the place served as a sort of park where teenagers and kids on BMXs could gather. They had even tried to set up part of it for skateboards, though this looked a bit hazardous to Kevin. Not a place to visit alone, at night. It was also fast becoming a haunt of dropouts and drug dealers.
Kevin was hoping to see a guy named William. He wasn't exactly a snout, but he was often open to supplying a little information for the price of a bottle of cider. All Kevin needed were a few names of people who might have cooked up the bungled fuel theft job. He liked Charlie Button and was keen to give the lad a hand to track the diesel thieves. He found William sitting with a couple of other rough sleepers outside the ruins of an old storehouse close to the railway line. He knew most of them by name, or at least recognized them, but tonight he noticed a new face in their ranks. Kevin had come prepared with a pocketful of chocolate bars. The stranger, a guy of around 40, Kevin supposed, snatched the chocolate from him, ripped the foil wrapper off and pushed the lot into his mouth. Kevin took careful note of his appearance for future reference. He was of medium build, stocky, with brown wavy hair, a dark complexion and a single earring in his left earlobe. From the state of his clothes, he had not been on the streets long. Kevin noted the grey and red rucksack that he kept very close to him. William nodded in the man's direction.
"Calls himself Barney."
Addressing the newcomer, he said,
"Kevin's okay, understand? He's all right."
Barney's brown eyes were frightened, distrustful. Another sign that he was no seasoned street dweller. Kevin stuck out his hand, but the man shrank back.
"William, got 5 minutes?"
"Got all the time in the world, Governor."
He stood up. "Want to take a walk around my country estate?"
They sauntered across to where a group of youngsters were gathered round their bikes listening to hip-hop on a mobile phone. Kevin took a fiver from his pocket and handed it surreptitiously to William.
"Wondered if you'd heard any rumours on the street about someone nicking red diesel and getting a blowback from the tank. Real mess, apparently. Total car crash of a job. Sort of thing the pros would have a right laugh over."
William pocketed the money and gave a short laugh.
"There's an art to carrying off that kind of racket. All the guys that I've come across are smarter than that. They can drain a tank and be away before you even know they were there. Ask around for me, Will. I'll come back tomorrow evening."
"With another fiver?"
William asked. "Find me a name, and it'll be more than that. I'll see what I can do."
For a while, they watched the kids scorching around the waste ground on their bikes, doing wheelies and yelling to each other. Then Kevin asked,
"How long has Barney been here? Looks like a rabbit caught in the headlights."
3 days, Kev, but he's told us nothing about himself."
William stared across the scrubby area at the slowly setting sun.
"Lovely, ain't it? Even over a dump like this, it's still beautiful."
Kevin knew that William was a bit of a street poet. Circumstances had made him homeless, but he had kept his dignity and often showed a very sensitive side, especially where the natural world was concerned. Then he abruptly added,
"But he's scared shitless about something. I know that much."
His words called a halt to Kevin's musings over William's virtues.
"I thought that too, but it must be pretty daunting landing here if you aren't used to it."
William shook his head.
"Nah, it's not that. It's something else. I'll find out soon enough, though. I always do. Now, officer, anything else I can do for you? Just stay safe, Will, that's all."
They walked back to the old store, where the little group were pulling sleeping bags and blankets together into temporary beds for the night. Kevin observed that Barney was still clutching his rucksack to him.
"Poor guy. It's bad enough finding yourself homeless, but to be terrified as well."
Shadows were starting to form. The music had fallen silent. The young bikers were leaving their makeshift park. Kevin could hear a blackbird somewhere.
"Night, guys. See you again," he called out. "Night, Barney. Good to meet you."
The man stood straighter, tentatively lifted a hand in a wave or a salute. As he did so, there was a sharp crack. Everyone froze, looking around in confusion. The man who called himself Barney went over backwards, hit the ground, and lay still. Kevin leapt forward,
yelling to the others to get down and out of the line of fire. He threw himself down next to Barney and saw instantly that there would be no saving him. A bullet had torn a ragged hole in his head. Immediately he was on his phone and calling for assistance. By the time he'd finished the frantic call, he was alone with the dead man. The others had melted away into the gathering darkness. Suddenly the waste ground was no longer a place where a beautiful sunset could still be appreciated, but was full of threat and menace. His fear began to mount. Was the sniper still out there? Was Kevin in his sights? Throat dry and palms sweaty, Kevin inched back into the ruined store and took cover. In the distance, the noise of two tones ripped the twilight apart. The station was only minutes away, but those minutes were very long. He found that he was shaking. Shock. It had happened so fast. The gesture the man had made was etched indelibly in his mind. Every time he closed his eyes, he saw the hand half raised. It looked like a farewell. Two deaths. Two shootings. Both discovered by him, and one had happened right in front of his eyes. Was this what he had signed up for? Blue lights were approaching, sirens wailing. Kevin blinked back tears of relief. He crept away from the ruined building and crouched over poor, homeless Barney. Automatically, he started to raise his hand to his fellow officers, then recalled that final gesture of Barney's. He brought his hand down quickly and called out, "Over here!" Now, men and women were running towards him. He saw faces he recognized, and then someone was throwing a foil blanket around his shoulders. "Come on, mate, let's get you out of here. I think you've had enough for one day." His sergeant propelled him towards an ambulance that was joining the other emergency vehicles. "Let these guys look after you and we'll talk later." Kevin opened his mouth, but no sound came out. All he could see was Barney's lifted hand, and all he could hear was a blackbird singing and the crack of a sniper rifle.